There's definitely many ways that somebody could not bother to be green in nutrition. And there's other things to consider in nutrition too that could make something not green, such as, are we emphasizing eating organic foods, or where does that food come from? There's multiple aspects to nutrition that not only have to do with health, but also with the environment that can very easily get overlooked. I want to see people moving in that direction. I don't want you to have this requirement that you have to have a perfect diet right now, because that's how a lot of people fall off the bandwagon and lose hope. But it's about progress, not perfection. And it's knowing that those little choices continue to make a difference.
Welcome to the Earth Keepers Podcast. This podcast is for people who seek new and better ways to love and care for the Earth. It's a podcast for anyone who is deeply concerned about the harm being done to the environment on a local and global level. It's a podcast that builds community and connection between people of like heart and mind, people who believe that Earth care should be integrated into every aspect of life, and for many in the Earth Keepers community, that includes our spiritual lives. Welcome, friends, to the Earth Keepers Podcast. Hey, Earth Keepers, here's a question for you. While all of us have found ways to make changes in order to live in more Earth-sustaining ways, how often do we pay attention to what we eat as a critical factor for an Earth-keeping lifestyle? I mean, think about the different foods that made up the last meal that you ate. I'm serious, take a few seconds to harken back to what you ate. Do you know where those foods came from? How they were produced, how those foods impact your carbon footprint. When it comes to eating in more earth-honoring ways, do we even know all the questions we should be asking? For example, I try to buy organic when I can, and when I can afford it, but honestly, while I know enough about organic food to understand that it's probably better for me, I'm not always so clear on whether and how organic food is better for the planet. Where I get really lost sometimes is in discussions about things like genetically modified food. I mean, really, when you try to listen past all the demonization of GMOs, how many of us really understand what the fuss is all about? Well, in this episode, I'll be talking to nutritionist Leslie Aaron, a person who helps people to answer questions like that for a living. In fact, Leslie works to promote community nutrition in places all over the world. She and her husband Douglas work as contractors with global nonprofits in development and disaster relief. They also have their own organization called Fulcrum Missions, which helps local churches and ministries to help people in ways that actually make sense for their specific contexts. In one of their most recent endeavors, for example, they've been working in Nicaragua to set up an aquaponics system. That is an approach to farming both fish and vegetables together in sustainable, environmentally sound ways. Leslie joins us now to help us figure out what it means to eat like an Earthkeeper. Leslie, it's so good to have you on the podcast. I really look forward to our conversation today. Let me start by asking a question. How did you become interested in nutrition? And how has that really become a theme of your vocational life so far?
Yeah, I became interested in nutrition during my teenage years. As I was looking at college, where do I go? What do I study? And all that, I felt like what I was supposed to do is business and those types of topics, because you're supposed to have a successful career and all that. And I was really looking at that with dread, and I did not want to go to college and study those boring things. But in the meantime, I had some developments in my life with my piano teacher was really interested in nutrition and was talking to me about it. And my dad was going through some health issues that caused him to start looking at his diet and fixing that. And so through that, I became interested in, well, what does this actually look like? And started to practice it, you know, at the household level, and asked my mom to switch to different foods that I thought were healthier and that kind of thing, and ultimately decided that I wanted to actually study nutrition. And so I chose Bastyr University, which is a university here in the Seattle area, and it's mostly known for being a naturopathic school, but they do have several other programs, and nutrition is one of them. And the approach with Bastyr is a very holistic approach to everything that they do, medicine, nutrition, psychology, all the different programs that they have. And through that, I learned about nutrition in a holistic way. A lot of times the approach is what we call nutritionism, which is really looking at the micronutrients in isolation as though you can separate them from food and not have any consequences to that. So at Bastyr, we learn about a holistic approach. And part of that is the importance of traditional diets and the role that they've played in sustaining human health for thousands of years. And that really informed my philosophy about nutrition. And when I graduated, I figured I was going to go into private practice, you know, some sort of clinical setting, that kind of thing. But first, I zipped off to South Africa and ended up staying there for 2 years and was working in an HIV/AIDS hospice and children's home and applying nutrition there. And through that, I became more interested in more community nutrition and really looking at how do traditional diets support health for people. And so with that, I came back home and did my master's in international care and community development, which helped continue to broaden that holistic approach of not just a holistic approach to nutrition, but how does nutrition fit into everything else more on a development scale. So that's really informed my nutrition work that I've done, those two degree programs and that background. And so when I do get the opportunity to work in nutrition abroad, that's what I'm bringing to the table is how can we look at what do people have locally available to them? What have people here been eating for generations? And how do we continue to promote that for good health?
Someone might hear the answer and think, well, why would you look at past dietary practices when we have modern technology and modern knowledge to provide much better sources of food?
That goes again to, like I mentioned, nutritionism and the idea that we can just break food down into these little micro components, whether that's vitamins and minerals or even phytonutrients, and we can just supplement everything, throw in a protein bar and call it nutrition. And one thing that really struck me was as I started traveling the world and watching people's, how they would eat and their traditional diets, and I would think, well, here, there's no microscope, there's no lab to show what vitamin A looks like. And yet somehow, people have been able to feed themselves for generations and generations and reproduce and be healthy. So there's really something to this. And there's been some great things that have come out of research and technological advances and being able to understand nutrition. But again, when we look at it as though we can just look at this single component and make solutions based off of it, that's how I believe we're continuing to see health degrade. In spite of all of our knowledge, in spite of all of our health advances, we're still seeing a rise of chronic diseases. So clearly, something's not adding up.
You also place a lot of importance on caring for creation, I know, and I wonder how that compassion for creation developed in you.
Yeah, again, that started with my time at Bastyr with that holistic approach. In my time there, I got to take courses along with the herbal medicine program, and I almost got a minor in herbal medicine while I was there. And especially even more so in herbal medicine courses was this idea of creation care, that these herbs that are very powerful, potent tools that we have available to us can be grown in a lab. They can't be synthesized. So the only way that we're going to keep those up is to be able to take care of creation. And in one of the classes that I took where we would do harvesting of wild foods and plants around, one of the philosophies that they taught came really from the indigenous peoples who were originally here in the Pacific Northwest. And the harvesting idea that they had with wild foods was that when you're harvesting, you leave a quarter for the animals, a quarter for the plant, a quarter for the creator, and a quarter is for yourself. And so in that way, there's that acknowledgement that we do need these plants. We do need this food to survive, but the plant needs it too. The animals do. And just as a way to honor the creator for giving it to us. And I really liked that philosophy that it's not just about what can I take out of the earth? What can I just grab and have for myself? But acknowledging that it's a whole system that everyone relies on outside of humanity too. And I feel like in today's world, with so much food being produced in a lab and so much manufacturing, it really separates us from this idea that food is so intricately linked to the planet. And that's where it comes from. And the modern system allows us to basically deny that we are dust, and to dust we will return. But when we're closer and connected to our food system, we realize that's where the food comes from, that's where nutrition comes from, that's where I'm ultimately going to go back to. And it's that whole cycle of life. And that is not going to be sustained if we are not taking care of the earth through our food choices.
In season 5 of the podcast, we're paying a lot of attention to the question, how can we green every vocation? And that question assumes that we can think creatively about the ways we do any job so that we're doing our work in ways that reduce harm to the planet and even promote environmental restoration. In some ways, you've already begun to answer this question I have for you, but let me ask, how have you sought to make your work as a nutritionist greener? What connections have you made between your work as a nutritionist and your environmental values?
I think one of the big things is to practice what I preach. I do a lot of teaching on nutrition, and that's the biggest way that I can live it out is when I teach people about how to eat healthy, how to eat holistically, how to engage in a traditional diet. I likewise have to do the same thing. That improves my practice as a nutritionist. It helps me understand what people go through and to have better compassion about how do you manage this? How do you manage to eat healthier and greener? And it also is just a way that I'm living that out, that every person who's practicing something is contributing something. And so that's where I see that importance. And another thing too, just a broader scope of that is really the value of simplifying the diet. I think sometimes when we start off and we decide that we want to eat healthier and we're going to start making these changes, it's very easy to get ensnared by the marketing of you have to have this or that exotic food to cure this or that problem. And I'm always reminded of this comic I saw, I think it was The Far Side or whatever, and somebody with a bottle of something and they said, oh, these are ancient yak tears from Mongolia harvested by monks. And it's like, there's this concept that healthy eating is these foods that come from all over the planet. And while there are healthy foods all over the planet, that doesn't mean they have to be brought here for me to eat healthy. And so that idea of simplifying your diet goes really a long way in making it greener. So that's what I teach.
By implication, it seems like then you would say eating local is part of eating simpler.
Yeah, absolutely.
The way you talk about being a nutritionist, practicing that vocation, it makes a lot of sense. It's hard to see it as a profession that can be done without being done in green ways. But I would say that my experience of nutritionists in other contexts would be experiences of people who might be recommending certain supplements and different vitamins and certain regimes of eating, which feel a little bit regimented and awkward. So is it true that in fact you could practice the profession of nutrition in ways that aren't green?
Yeah, absolutely. Just exactly like you said, this idea that we have to go to these far extents, we have to rely on labs to feed us. We have to rely on this ancient food from this tucked away corner of the planet. And of course, it has to be imported here in order to eat healthy. Yeah, there's definitely many ways that somebody could not bother to be green in nutrition. And there's other things to consider in nutrition too that could make something not green, such as, are we emphasizing eating organic foods? Or where does that food come from? There's multiple aspects to nutrition that not only have to do with health, but also with the environment that can very easily get overlooked.
I wonder if you could help us to understand the work that you do by maybe telling a story or two of how you've seen this relationship between your vocation and environmental values come together in your work.
I think it's difficult to talk about the work that I've done without talking about the role of globalization in the food system. And globalization has really impacted what's available to us and who gets to eat what foods. There have been some wonderful things that have come out of globalization, but there's also been some things that have really been impactful in the food system in devastating ways that I've seen abroad. And the biggest one of that is, of course, developing nations right now are a really hot spot for food marketing and for food products. Many companies have openly admitted that is their newest market. That is who they're expanding out to, is this untapped world of new consumers who are coming up as we're slowly seeing poverty alleviation finally coming through. And as we're seeing more development, more infrastructure, all of that is paving ways for processed foods to make their way into these countries and into these groups where people have not seen these types of foods before. And it doesn't matter what corner of the world you go into, you will find processed foods at this point. You can find Coca-Cola in the most remote village in Uganda. I was recently in South Sudan, and even the cooking oil that they're using there is these industrialized seed oils that have never been part of any traditional diet, and yet that's the common cooking oil because it's the cheapest. I see mothers feeding Coca-Cola and French fries to their two-year-old child. And this isn't because that's necessarily what they think is the healthiest. And I'm certainly not saying it in any way to condemn anyone. It's just the reality of when these food changes happen so rapidly and become so available for so cheap, this is what people end up choosing. And so a lot of my work that I end up doing is really about going back and reemphasizing those foods that are the traditional foods that you would eat. A lot of my work is in what we call infant and young child feeding. That's the very big focus in nutrition on a global level. And it's really looking at the first 1,000 days of life from the womb till a child is about 2 years old. These are the most impactful years of nutrition in a child's life. And so we talk about the importance of nutrition during pregnancy, the importance of breastfeeding, and then the importance of transitioning into complementary feeding and what to feed a child. And through all of this, the emphasis is always on what do you have available here that's always been here that doesn't come in a package, and getting a child started off correctly with that, and really encouraging women in particular, since they do most of the child rearing, of how to feed your child in a healthy way. You know, a lot of times it's just something that people don't really think about. They see this or that food that's easy to grab, it's in a package, it's ready to go, and it makes my child happy, so I'm going to feed that to them. And so by introducing, again, the idea of the importance of these traditional diets, really helps solidify that that's going to be the best thing for your family.
There are a lot of ways that are widely understood that all of us can change our behaviors to live in more earth-honoring ways, like going solar or recycling or planting trees or getting involved in community activism. But I'm not sure that most people have considered changing what they eat as a way to become a better earth keeper. So I wonder, should we be paying more attention to that relatively mundane part of our lives? And how do our choices about what to eat make any difference at all to the greater good of the planet?
It is a mundane part of life, but it's an area that we have the ability to have tremendous impact on the environment. And I think a lot of people are already familiar with the concept of organic eating and buying organic foods that have not been so heavily processed with herbicides and pesticides and different chemicals like that. And there's really been that whole movement towards organic. And I think a lot of people, when they're familiar with it and they're excited about taking care of the environment, they feel great about going to the store and I bought organic broccoli instead of conventional broccoli. And that's great. I love that it's become so much more common that we see organic foods in your regular grocery store, which was something that was hard to find 15, 20 years ago. It was relegated to those health food stores or some back corner of a store or whatever. And now it's in so many stores just blended right in alongside of everything else. And that's the power of people making those small choices that I'm going to choose to buy the organic variety today and not the conventional one. The producers have heard that, stores have heard that, and they're responding to that, which goes to show that, yeah, those mundane choices do make a big difference. But there is also a lot more we can do besides buying organic. It doesn't have to end there. And to me, the biggest issue, I think, goes back to these ultra-processed foods and where they come from. So what is an ultra-processed food? We kind of have a sense of it, but just to break it down a little bit, in nutrition, we generally categorize things into three categories. You have your whole foods, which is not the store. It's a type of labeling for food to say it has one ingredient itself. It's not been processed. You know, maybe it's been washed. You know, maybe the carrots had the dirt washed off of it. Maybe the greens have been cut off, but otherwise it's been not processed. It's something that you could actually visualize growing. In all my travels, I've never seen a marshmallow tree. I have not found the river of Sprite, plucked Snickers off the Snickers bush. You can imagine it growing. It has one ingredient, and it has not had anything done to it since it's been harvested. These are whole foods. They've been feeding people for thousands of years. Then you have your slightly processed foods, which are also traditional foods, things like cheese and yogurt, vinegar, different things like that, that have, again, been part of humanity for a long time, do have a very central role in the diet, certainly among particular cultures. And they may not be a whole food. They may contain only parts of food, or they may have certain things added to it. But overall, it's been part of human processing for a long time. And then there's the ultra-processed foods, which are basically foods that have come around since the Industrial Revolution that are manufactured in a lab. They have ingredients that you can't pronounce, you would never find in your kitchen. Even if you did want to buy them, you can't find them at the store. And they've had extensive amount of work done to them of heating and breaking them up and tearing them down and re-putting them back into a different shape. And the other big thing with them is they're made out of some of the most common ingredients of soy, wheat, corn, or maize, and sugar, and industrial seed oils such as canola, sunflower seed, safflower seed. Those ingredients that I just listed there make up a good 70% of the caloric content of these ultra-processed foods. So suddenly we're not having a diverse diet. We're having it come down to five basic ingredients. Depending on the research that you read, the American diet will have up to 80% of calories coming from ultra-processed foods. Other westernized countries match similar levels. And a lot of the global south and up-and-coming countries are quickly matching these numbers as well. The problem with some of these ingredients is not necessarily what they are. Soy, maize, wheat, these are traditional foods for different people groups and have been for a long time. Some of them aren't. Canola has never been a traditional food. Sunflower, while we have eaten seeds, takes an incredible industrial process to turn it into oil, not a traditional food. Same with safflower oil, not a traditional food. But it's also, what are the growing methods used for these and how are those affecting the environment? And what we see, especially with soy and with maize, is that these are large industrial processes of monocropping, where you have thousands or tens of thousands of acres dedicated to that specific variety of that plant, which is not how anything has ever grown in the history of the planet. You don't see that in nature. And for a lot of good reasons, it's not very protective of the plants. It doesn't support a biodiverse environment, so it doesn't feed any of the animals around it. And it's not very resistant to shocks that might come up. But we grow foods that way, because it's great for industry. It's great for taking those ginormous tractors through and being able to harvest just tons and tons of food all at once. It's really set up to do well for manufacturing. And nutrition and the environment are secondary, tertiary thoughts, if they're thought much of at all. A lot of these plants are grown in a way that are meant to be able to consume more herbicides and pesticides. They're genetically modified. And originally we were told genetic modification was going to be great because we're going to solve nutrition problems. We're going to be able to put nutrients into foods that never existed there before. And while there's been some movement in that direction, by and large, what genetic modification has allowed us to do is to spray these plants with even more pesticides and herbicides. Because as the pests gain resistance and as the weeds gain resistance, we have to have stronger chemicals to keep up this whole system. So a lot of that is really just to support that whole system. And this is where we're seeing soil erosion in the Midwest of the US, is where we're seeing deforestation in a lot of places in South America and Indonesia. Those two are particularly heavily hit as the land is deforested to be able to grow more soy and maize. And it's not just the Amazon. There's been protections being put in place for the Amazon rainforest. You're slowly working in that direction, but then that means other natural forests are now being degraded. So there's still a lot of work to be done on that. So not only do these foods that are grown support this ultra-processed food system, it's also what we're feeding the animals to, all the livestock, the cows, the pork, chicken, even fish are getting fed corn and soy as their diet, which is contributing to, again, more deforestation, more heavy use of pesticides and herbicides, because we've got to continue to feed this system. As the world overall gets richer and there's higher demand for these types of foods, it continues to contribute to this. So I think that one of the big ways that we can make changes in our diet to support the environment is not only buying organic, but I think, honestly, more importantly, is getting rid of ultra-processed foods from our diet and sourcing animal products that are not raised on those same crops that are causing so much damage to the environment.
So I think about your comments about whole foods, for example, and it seems to me that even if you're talking about carrots, even carrots as a whole food can be grown in ways that are not earth-friendly, that are destructive, even though the food itself maybe is higher ranked in terms of nutrition and health.
Yeah, you can have organic or conventionally raised carrots. You can, even if it's an organic process, you can still do monocropping with it, which is not the most supportive for the environment. It doesn't feed back into the soil that way. So yeah, there's even among these whole foods, which are certainly a step in the right direction towards diversity of the diet and for the planet, there's still a lot of work that can be dug into with that.
Well, speaking of the work of earthkeeping, we're going to take a quick break to hear about a new resource we're offering to help people discover their own capacities in ecological leadership and change making.
Hi, this is James. Do you ever wonder what it means to practice your faith in a time of ecological crisis? Or what skills and practices are needed to lead communities towards new forms of identity, community, and mission that bring healing and renewal? These are the questions that Circlewood's upcoming Ecological Christian Leadership Cohort will be exploring. This cohort will run from late February to mid-May, and my co-leader, Forrest, and I will help participants expand their understanding of eco-theology and spirituality, see how faith should be informed and shaped by the places we live and work, and learn how to guide others on the journey. It is open to anyone with a leadership role, whether that's formal or informal, paid or volunteer, in their church, community, or workplace. We have an interesting and diverse group already forming that includes a few pastors, a nonprofit leader, a nature retreat guide, a camp administrator, and a filmmaker, and there's still room for a few more. I believe this creative cohort can transform your faith and leadership, as it did for this past participant.
I'm Halleck Greider, and I pastor Maplewood Presbyterian Church in Edmonds, Washington. I was part of the first Ecological Leaders cohort last year, and it was one of my favorite and most enriching experiences in pastoral ministry in recent years. Because it was more than just learning about ecological issues and environmental activism. For me, it was a retooling of my entire view of leadership and theology. Being part of the cohort began to change how and what I preach, how I lead the congregation, and has even influenced my spiritual journey as I am learning how to see myself and everything as part of the great web of life that God has created. An equally enriching aspect of the cohort was our time together. Hearing others' stories, ideas, and struggles encouraged me and reminded me that I am not alone in this work. So for those who will participate, be open to surprises and serendipity, and know that this is simply a beginning point for a new trajectory in your discipleship and leadership.
I hope you will consider joining us. You can learn more and register at circlewood.online.
It seems to me that what you're advocating for those who maybe want to eat healthier, but also want to eat in ways that are healthier for the planet, is intentionality, is actually taking the time to understand where your food comes from, how it's produced, how it's sourced, even connecting it to issues of social justice, right? I mean, who is it that actually works on the farms that produce these foods? It seems like a lot of work, and I'm not sure your average consumer would really want to take the time to be so informed, so attentive, so intentional about making the choices. What do you say to those people who perhaps say, I don't have the capacity to be so informed?
It is a challenge. It is very overwhelming. A lot of people, as they start digging into this, get a sense of hopelessness that they can't make a difference. It's too much to learn. But I do think that there's ways that you can kind of combat that and still make informed choices, even if you don't dedicate to researching the topics. Again, just looking for basic organic labeling, fair trade. There's things that aren't perfect about those labels, but it's a helpful way. It's a stamp right there on a package. That's an easy way to say, okay, this has passed some sort of quality check. I may not understand all the reasons behind it. I may not know, is this the best choice or not, but it's a step in the right direction. There's more and more labeling on animal products too. You'll see words like cage-free, free-range, pasture-raised. And these are labels that mean something to some degree. Again, it's not necessarily just buying cage-free doesn't mean that the chickens were not fed corn and soy as their diet, but they were not enclosed in a cage. And so there's things that you can look for that, again, is a helpful step in the right direction. I think also going to farmers markets as well. If you're going to be buying fruits, vegetables, animal products, farmers markets are great resources. They may not necessarily be labeled organic because it's an expensive process to be a certified organic farm, but that doesn't mean they aren't practicing that. And there is also still the value of, is it better to have a local food that's not certified organic or import something that came from Chile that, yeah, it's been labeled as organic, but it flew 5,000 plus miles to get here. So there's choices like that that you can make. I think continuing to push a little bit goes a long way. My food journey has been years in the process. I did not wake up one morning and suddenly everything I ate was perfect. And it still isn't. There's still room that I have for growth. But I think taking a moment to make a consideration and moving in that direction is what's helpful. It's really that way, even with broader nutrition advice when we're looking at health issues, is that I want to see people moving in that direction. I don't want you to have this requirement that you have to have a perfect diet right now, because that's how a lot of people fall off the bandwagon and lose hope. But it's about progress, not perfection. And it's knowing that those little choices continue to make a difference.
Yeah, so taking a more incremental approach to change just so you don't get overwhelmed and then want to quit. There's a lot of wisdom in that.
Yeah, exactly. There's ways that you can prioritize what foods that you are going to choose to maybe purchase organic or choose to not purchase processed and instead purchase a more whole food variety that fit within your budget or within your means for food preparation or whatever your circumstances may be.
Behind your words, it seems to me that there are just some ethical and moral issues involved. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is, sure, we can source our strawberries better, right? But if you really look at strawberries as a food, is it right for us to feel so privileged in our capacity to choose that we need strawberries in January, when we know very well the strawberries don't grow in January where we live, at least not where I live? So that means I've got to access the system that produces strawberries en masse and transports them using great amounts of fuel to get to me just so I can have the strawberries. I'm not sure that we always even ask those fundamentally hard questions, not just choosing better strawberries, but asking the question, is it right to feel so privileged at all to be able to choose any food we want anytime versus living more according to our means and our context? What do you think about that?
That's, again, the blessed curse of globalization. I can go to the store right now and buy a pineapple here in Seattle, and I've never seen pineapples to grow here in Seattle, but I can buy that if I want. And there's incredible blessings that have come out of that, of the things that we've been able to try, the cuisines that we have access to. But if this touches your heart in a way of, I need to make some changes, then we have to consider that an ethical way of eating. And like with the pineapple instance, my husband and I love tropical fruits. We don't eat tropical fruits unless we are in a place that grows them. I mean, for one, it's even just a taste thing. Like, they don't taste good by the time they come up here. But it's also this issue of, what are we doing? Why are we buying that when that's really not appropriate for this setting? And instead focusing on what is here locally, which is the benefit of purchasing locally, is it's automatically in season as well. And so it kind of knocks out a lot of those questions of, well, is it in season? Is it, what do I do? And I've found that over the years that as I've tuned in more to eating in a way that's realistic to what my environment around me provides, that I actually start finding it strange and off-putting to consider eating foods that are not available. Like, I don't eat salads in the winter. It just sounds strange to me. I'm like, how is that even nourishing to my body when it's so cold here and I'm eating this very light, delicate lettuce that's a spring food? And so as I've worked through that, I've found that my body naturally starts to develop this understanding of, these are what winter foods are, these are what summer foods are, and this is what's going to nourish you in these seasons. And my shopping reflects that.
It's striking me, just in terms of the challenge of your words, that if we really do want to embody earth-loving values in our eating practices, it takes some moral courage. If we really are looking at what we do in terms of our eating practices, there are a lot of things that need to be questioned. And I think even that's overwhelming, but to come back to your incremental approach, I think that there's wisdom in that, and it becomes more possible if we take stock of our eating habits, our family's eating habits, and then make choices. Well, this is one thing I can change right now. This is one thing I can learn about right now. And maybe in a month, we'll move on to something else.
Yeah. And like I said, those people making those incremental changes is the reason why we're seeing more and more of these options available to us in the stores, because people are slowly, maybe randomly, one day buying organic lettuce and the next day not. But they're continuing to make these conscious choices imperfectly, but it is changing our system.
You know, it strikes me also that perhaps one way to approach these challenges of changing might have something to do with community. I think specifically about friends of the podcast, Abby Persson and Liesl Stewart in South Africa, and they started a co-op for two reasons, as I understand it. One, they wanted, first of all, to learn together about how to make better food choices, how to source things locally, how to source things organically, etc., but to do so as a group, as a band of people wanting to learn together and helping each other to learn together. But of course, their second and primary objective was to actually find ways to make those foods more available. And so they, as a co-op, would contract with a farmer, a local farmer, to produce a certain crop and then to promise to buy that crop once it's ready. And so right away, they were not only guaranteeing the source of these good foods that we're learning about, but they were also making sure that they were affordable, because that often is an issue with eating healthy, I would say, is that sometimes it can be a bit more pricey. But community allows you, I think, to make choices like that together and perhaps to make those changes more readily. Have you seen that happen in contexts that you've worked in?
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, and I definitely agree with it. I see that very naturally play out in, certainly in more rural, undeveloped environments where you don't have a choice but to rely on each other. And that's, again, the downside of development and of the luxury we have now of manufacturing whatever we want in the lab, is that that does disconnect us from the community. I don't need my neighbor anymore, because I've got the grocery store down the road that's supported by the giant food manufacturing lab that's multiple states away from me. And so, yeah, we lose that sense of connection. I do see people having this reconciliation that community does go together with food, and just kind of getting back to the basics of what has supported and sustained humanity for countless generations. It's our local environment, which also includes the local people around us.
So as we near the end of our conversation here, I'm a little bit overwhelmed. I'm making notes, though, about the lessons that I think I'm taking away from this, and I'll just run those by you to ask if you would add anything to them. One thing I'm hearing is that clearly we've got to be more intentional about making our food choices, and that means becoming more educated, taking time to learn about where our food comes from. I think in general, for health and environment reasons, you're recommending that we consider more whole foods or minimally processed foods that we can learn from indigenous folks about traditional diets, which kind of run counter to the globalization diet that you were describing, that community could be part of the solution to eating better, to learn together and perhaps even collaborate to source food better. And maybe finally, for me at least, is this idea of having the moral courage to really look at what you eat and how you eat, and to be ready to say, this is not right in terms of social justice, in terms of environmental justice. These things that I consider my rights and privileges maybe need to be questioned and reevaluated. How am I doing so far? What would you add to that, or what would you expand on? It's a lot.
It is a lot. I do think that you've summed it up pretty well of what my main points are. I think with that is going back to traditional diets does mean that it is a lifestyle change as well. And my number one recommendation, whether somebody is asking about how do I get healthier, or they're saying, I care about the environment, what do I do? My number one recommendation is always remove the processed foods from your diet. I don't care so much about what does that end up looking like? How many carbs is it? Is it vegetarian or is it omnivorous? That's not what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about getting rid of those processed foods. And that takes time. Again, it's the baby steps. It's maybe instead of buying that pack of quick cook oatmeal that you throw in with some boiled water and it's loaded with sugar and it's chopped up to this fine smithereens, maybe instead of that, just switch to thick rolled oats or steel cut oats. It's a step in that direction. Learning cooking skills. I think sometimes that's a barrier for people as they get into eating processed foods because they don't feel that they have the cooking skills to make whole foods healthy and exciting to eat. They think they're just going to eat a bowl of raw carrots and some walnuts and good grief, I have to eat like this for 40 years. Well, forget it. But learning some basic cooking skills can go a really long way in making the diet more appealing and also encouraging that I can actually do this and that I am making a difference for the planet and for myself. Ultimately, it's making those steps where you can. And as you do it, it gets easier and it gets more rewarding. And then you look back at the way you used to eat and you think, oh my goodness, I couldn't eat like that now. Like that is not appealing anymore. So it's worth it.
If you were to say just one final word of encouragement to folks listening, especially those who might be a bit overwhelmed about some of these issues, what would you say to them about pressing on?
Yeah, again, I can't emphasize enough that it's not about being perfect. It's about making the changes where you can. Stretch yourself where you can. Don't just give up that, well, I can't do that. I don't have the time. I don't have the money for it. Maybe you don't have the time and money for an overnight change or even the change within a year or 2 or 3 years, but stretch yourself a little bit. Well, what if I purchased the organic meat instead of the conventional meat? What if instead of popping open a can of soup, I made it myself? And just starting with those small things, but continuing to make those as challenges in your life. It's good to be challenged. It's good. That's how we grow. That's how we thrive. We have to build resistance. We have to be challenged in ways. And the diet is no different than anything else in life. And so that's what I would say is challenge yourself. Pick one of these things that has really touched upon you or thing that you feel the most passionate about and say, I'm going to dive into this deeper and see what it looks like if I make a change in this direction and see where that leads you.
We've been in conversation with nutrition professional Leslie Aaron about paying attention to the foods we eat as a factor in living a more earth-friendly, sustainable lifestyle. To learn more about her work and to see some of the resources that she recommends for those who are inspired to make such changes, go to the show notes for this episode at earthkeepers.online. You'll also find a link there for more information about Circlewood's Ecological Leaders Cohort. I'm Forrest Inslee, your podcast host. Our executive producer is James Avedon, and our producer is Dave Ulfers. Colleen Meggerly is our editor and researcher. Forrest Reed is the creator of our original music, and Jesselyn Gentry is our social media director. Thank you, friends, for listening. And please join us for our next conversation on the Earthkeepers podcast.